Welcome to Come and See, your podcast for finding truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. With host and founder, Richard Case, and co-host and retreat leader, Kathy Riccone. Jesus reminds us to watch for the signs of his return. Today, we will explore further what we are seeing in our times that line up with what signs he said would indicate the potential of the end and his return. We will also discuss the practical meaning of this as we watch and as a remnant prepare as he so leads. And now your host, Richard Case.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is End Times Friday, and this will be airing on the 19th of April. And we have our special guest, our monthly guest now, Denny Weinberg from Santa Rosa Valley in California. Mm-hmm. And didn't you guys just, Denny, have a harvest of your avocados?
We did. We just completed it last week. We picked 100,001 wow. pounds of avocados.
Is that what would be considered a good harvest, a medium? What is that in realms for those of us who don't know?
That's the best harvest.
What kind of year did we have?
best harvest we've ever had.
Amazing.
In weight of fruit. So our trees really did well.
That's awesome.
That's great. And the they actually track them from your ranch, right? And then you can ultimately know kind of where they wind up.
Oh, yeah. Any chance any come to New Hampshire?
I don't know. But, you know, when you buy an avocado, a little sticker on it, that sticker is basically the pathway back to its origin within probably 50 trees.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
Have you ever gone into a store and say, hey, that's my avocado?
I try and look, but, you know, they ship them all over the place from here.
Yeah.
This is a big part of the U.S. Avocado industry is sourced in the county that I live in.
Mm. Yeah, it's beautiful. How's your water doing out there?
Great. You know, we got more rain coming this weekend. It's just the last couple of years, after all, you know, 5 years of doom and gloom because of, you know, drought, the last couple of years have been incredibly wet. The reservoirs all through California are full. They're actually spilling them over right now because the snow melt will accumulate water later in the year faster than they can drain them. So they actually have to anticipate the snow melt and then drain water away into the ocean. We've got
Well, we're happy to have you on again. We thank you so much for the ability to give us updates on Israel and insight mm-hmm. about Israel. And we're excited. Last time we had talked about, Denny had discussed the understanding of the two-state solution, and actually it had been put in place back when, and the extremists never really accepted it and didn't embrace it, and therefore they never had it. So it's interesting, and Denny sent me the maps on this, so I can put them up for us. Now, you that are listening, Denny will describe it to you, and then if you have an interest in looking at the maps, for sure you can email us and say, hey, I'd like to get a copy of those, and we can get them to you. But, Denny, why don't you walk us through kind of a recap of where we left at last time, and we can just walk through these maps a little bit, and then we can start with the update on Israel.
Sure. But I guess first I should say I'm not a history expert. I didn't even do very well in high school studying history. But, you know, it's become important and interesting to me as a Jew to think, you know, first of all, be challenged by the world's narrative that, you know, Palestine, 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 free Palestine, mm-hmm. free Palestine. And so, you know, as part of going back and looking at it, this question of who was Palestine, who is Palestine, mm-hmm. you know, the history is very different than what we hear today. Yeah. And so three maps sort of go through three important periods of time that established the Middle East as we know it today, both the things that people agree on, the things that people don't agree on, are all embedded in it. The first map that you know that you'll make available to people talks about the end of World War I and the Ottoman Empire. We all probably don't remember this. I certainly didn't. But the big nations of that time were the Persian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. Arabia, and Much of this was settled because the Ottoman Empire was taken apart, disassembled at the end of the First World War.
And by the way, just to help everybody get a context for that, is that the Ottoman Empire had joined the German and the Italian at what they call the Axis. And when they all lost, you know, Germany and Italy had impact of that and how they handled that. And then the Ottomans, because they were part of the loss of that, had to, and as part of the surrender, they had to agree to the terms that were set up in the map here that Denny's showing are the terms that because they lost the war, they had to accept it.
Yeah. And so the Allies sort of took control in sections. There's a French zone. There's a British influence zone. There was a red zone that was sort of temporarily British controlled. And what happened during that time, between that time and World War II, is the British just got tired of this sort of temporary holding path. Mm-hmm. And so they lateraled this to the United Nations to say, you've got to resolve this. And the second map that Rich has included, which has, it's titled Palestine on the map, but yep, is the result of the work that the UN did and what to try and create a separate and distinct new set of a new map. And interesting there, the principle that they used was this principle of self-determination, yep, that the people of these areas, when they come together, they should have the right to create new states their own way. And it was a really important function. And the second thing, which we still talk about today, was there were two. There was one that was the creation, and they were two states joined economically, but separate. And the formation of one was the, what it says is the formation of autonomous Jewish and Palestinian areas.
Yeah.
And this map shows what was the Jewish part of this territory and what was the Palestinian part of it. That's really the first time that Palestine didn't, the word Palestine didn't mean the Jewish people or and others that dwelled there. See, from biblical times on, this term Palestine referred to the children of Israel.
Yeah.
Once they landed in the promised land, you know, Canaan and all of that, that this all became this land. So this work of the United Nations was intended to create two states, but what ended up happening is one got defined as the Jewish state, the other defined as the Palestinian state. Mm-hmm. What happened going forward is, and we know this just looking today, the Jewish people took this idea of autonomous rule seriously. And the others said, we don't really want to have our own state. We just want to be part of the greater Arab nation. And they just languished for years and years and years.
Yeah. And by the way, on this map, Denny, the, you know, it's the green is the Jewish and the brown is the Arab.
Yeah.
If you look on the left of the Mediterranean there, that's what's called Gaza. And then what's that big brown section in the middle? What's that called?
Well, today, some of that, a big part of that today is the West Bank.
Yeah, West
but
Bank.
It's interesting. If you look at the cities that are there, and if this were broken down by population centers, what was left to the Jews in the, it became the, you know, the state of Israel, the Jewish state at the time, was very low population, the most arid, most desertest part of this land. All the big cities, all the populations were identified as Arab states. So they had a huge head start to create, you know, a new land for themselves and a new country and a new self-governed country for themselves. Wars since then redefined some of this. Borders were expanded, contracted, and that is what ends us at the point of the creation of the state of Israel in your third in your third map, Rich, echoes from the creation of Israel through several wars that redefined geographies. And you can still see that West Bank sort of there, but it's gotten compressed a lot.
Yep.
And along the way, you probably remember this not too long ago, Israel took over huge portions beyond this area into Jordan and into Egypt. And those, and then they move back from those boundaries to these sort of historic state boundaries. And that's what we know of as Israel today.
Yeah. And when you think of the extremists right now on this map here, you see that little section called Gaza. That's where Hamas basically headquartered and was using that to attack Israel in various places, which they started with the October 7th war in a big way. That was Gaza. And then on the north side of that, you see Lebanon. That is where Hezbollah is located. And they try to attack it from the north. And then, of course, Iran is we don't see that on the map here, but it's ability because of their missiles and things, they can attack over all this into it. So you've got north, south, and in this case, east of extremists that would like to eliminate that what's called what looks at blue. They want to eliminate the whole thing.
And it also tells you why it was so important for Egypt to reach some kind of an agreement. I mean, for Israel to reach some kind of an agreement with Israel. And then over time, agreements of some kind with Jordan, because there's such a huge amount of the border of Israel that is related to those two countries, including Gaza. You know, Gaza, while it's got a very thin slice of a boundary with Egypt, that is where Rafah is, right at that boundary. And so the vast amount of Gaza population is right at the Egyptian border. Those gates and those borders are absolutely closed tight.
Yeah.
And so Egypt doesn't allow any Arabs in the Gaza Strip to come across that border and find refuge in Egypt. And that's one of the reasons that today this all the controversy worldwide is that Israel has pushed the residents of Gaza down, you know, up against no place to go. It's not because of the ocean. It's because Egypt doesn't want them to enter.
Right. Right. That's right.
Was that, do you know if that was limited prior to October 7th also? Was that pretty tightly controlled at that point? Okay.
It was. When I look back on some of these articles that have been written back to 2011 and 2012 and 13 by reporters in the area, it was very clear even back then that there was a Gaza problem.
Okay.
And it was, you know, it obviously we're much more aware of it now because of the intensity of the current war.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, that's a great catch up, highlighting again of where we are today. So particularly if we can describe it, the land of Israel is really most of the biblical land that were given to them on that little sliver on the left of Mediterranean. Its southern portion is Gaza, which is where Hezbollah is, and Egypt, you can see that is on the border of that. And the interesting thing is that this whole discussion about refugees, Egypt won't let them in. So they say no. And then on the north side is Lebanon with Hezbollah. And so we can see, Denny, thank you for taking us through that progression of really how it got to this point. And it's really interesting. It all happened, by the way, after World War One. So just over 100 years now. And they became a nation in 47, and they won the Six-Day War in 67. And they function as a country with a conflict of people that would like to eliminate them. So that's interesting.
You know, it's only in the most recent graph of the three that you show that – you notice this, that Jerusalem is coterminous with the state of Israel.
Yeah.
Initially, it was an island, and it was designated in its own way as sort of jointly governed. And so now the capital of Israel in Jerusalem is now, at least you can get to Jerusalem from Israel without having to go across to another country.
Right. That's right.
An enemy country.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, Denny, thank you for that. And, based on the latest, and there's lots going on over there, tell us what is happening and help explain the situation, what they're thinking over there, where it might go next. And, you know, just kind of we'll kind of help process that. And we'd like to, you know, do that this session and next session as well. So, go ahead and bring us up to date.
So what's, if I was going to think of the themes that I get from both what I'm reading and in the daily blogs that I follow with my buddies over there. The world situation has, the world opinion has had an impact. That's probably the most, probably the most important. It, it's, you know, you see there are protests in Israel, big protests in Israel. And a lot, and that has been, you know, amplified by the world opinion. The shocking thing is that the, we hear nothing of this over here, but over there, the protests are in two, you know, with two topics. One, where are our hostages? And if this government can't get our hostages released, we'll get another government that will. And the second one is about the you know, the war itself. But there is as much protest on the war itself that the current government is not being aggressive of enough as it is that those that the current government is being is overreaching. That's what that's the sort of the media and public reaction views over there. They are really angry at the at the two or three responses that have come from the U.S. government. I mean, really angry at the United States. The people are. How could Schumer have said what he said, being a Jew? You know, they just can't get over that.
Right. And how could you recap, just for purpose of this conversation, what that was that Schumer said?
Well, Schumer started it saying that Israel, you know, has should negotiate or should open up a ceasefire so that all these other things can happen, release of the hostages and all of that, and the fighting will stop. And I think his he may have even gone so far as to say a permanent ceasefire, but I can't remember if that's what he said. But the fact that he brought that up when Israel was attacked, and you know, so they're angry about that.
Right.
President has gone back and forth. You know, he's ambiguous, he's contradictory, but they're not happy with that either. What I also hear is this is all for U.S. A lot of this is all for U.S. political purposes. And when Blinken and others are over there, the private conversations are all about, you know, you're going to do what you're going to do. Let's figure out how to cover ourselves, you know, with our own press and with our own political stuff. So I don't see anything in what I'm reading and hearing that the that goal number one of Israel, which is to wipe out Hamas so they can't re-infiltrate, that's gone. What I am reading about is the reality of how long this war is going to go on. That there are quotes in Israeli press that the defense minister, the head of the unified government have both made statements that this is probably a couple of years of fighting now. Probably won't be as visible. And because of some of the pullback of resources in central and northern Gaza, that Hamas has already repopulated some of its places, and they're going to have to go in and take them out again. And they blame that a bit on Biden. Although there's also this idea that they needed to regroup and some of their forces. I think they believe they're well equipped to deal with a war on many fronts. I see a lot of reporting on what's been going on with people's GPS systems, and they're certain that GPS systems are being reprogrammed and jammed to deal with more guided missiles that may, you know, come into Israel. And, you know, there are people that have gotten in their car to go somewhere and, you know, in Jerusalem, and it's showing them in Beirut. So they all know that's what's going on. They have a lot of trust in their government. And their defensive capabilities to deal with this. So there is a belief they can deal with a multi-front war. They're expecting even potentially an attack directly from Iran. And I guess we'll see. So I don't see anything in terms of their determination in the way they're reporting the sort of the mental health of Israelis. They view this as survival, and they continue to view it as survival, and there's no choice.
Let's talk about a couple things there, Denny. What is the population that is actually encouraging their government to keep going? What is driving them to want to do that? Because historically, there has been lots of positions on that, but it seems like the populace of Israel is all unified, in a sense, is we want you to press this, and we want this to happen. What is driving them? What happened here, and what's driving them to that position? And then we'll talk about, come back and talk about the difficulty of why would a war take longer than we thought, you know? So answer the first one first, and we'll come to the next one.
Yeah, I think this is not a new story for them. One of the articles I'm going to give you is titled An Insider's Guide to the Most Important Story on Earth. And it's an article that was written about Israel and Gaza in 2011. Mm. And it was an AP reporter, a former AP reporter that wrote this. And so I'll get that to you. But what if you you start reading this and you think it's something that was written a couple of weeks ago? Because the tension between Gaza and Israel was and there was some, you know, skirmishes, you know, between, 15 years ago and today that have occurred. There have been incursions. There have been small things that, you know, and flare ups. So I think the Israeli people don't view this as anything new. And that's why they're dug in. They're used to that. This is going to be a fight until the end, sooner or later. And that's one thing we don't fully appreciate. I think the nature of how brutal and horrible the attack was and how surprised they were emboldened them. But they were already there. I think that's the main thing. They just view this as something that has to be dealt with, has always had to be dealt with, and now because they were attacked in the way they were attacked, they now have, you know, they believe this is not an overreaction. They believe this was going to be destiny sooner or later.
Yeah, and so their thought is that we'd like to, let's say, eliminate this threat that's always been there, and because of what they did, they want to all go after that, and their desire would be that there just isn't any more threat coming from that Hamas and from Gaza. But they're finding out that it's not that easy, right?
It's not that easy. You know, they have taken out 2/3 of the tunnels, which were more widespread than they knew. But they also had been tracking some of these tunnels. I saw a video the other day of two very, very large tunnels being blown up. They filmed it, and they said they've known about these tunnels, and these tunnels were for 10 years. And these tunnels, they've already put sensing equipment in these tunnels. They put explosives hidden. Whenever they wanted to do it, they could blow them up. But they've tracked huge amounts of intelligence in some of these tunnels. But beyond that, it's so much more widespread.
And the tunnels were all underneath the cities?
Yeah, and they're way down underneath the cities. Wow. And they connect cities to cities. They go over borders. They go deep into it's not just down in the southern border. They see tunnels like this up into Lebanon, too. And so they know this tunneling thing has been, you know, for many, many years, a huge, project of construction, because they're big. You can walk through them. They're lit. You've seen some of these pictures. They have bathrooms in them. They have meeting rooms. And many of them have their headquarters or their exit and entrances under hospitals and schools, not just the one that we've seen all the news on, but many. And so they knew that ultimately the war would have to be fought the way it's going to be fought. There's going to be worldwide controversy about, destroying hospitals as they did this, because that's how they have prepared for the fight.
Yeah. Yeah. And what is causing the difficulty in trying to finish it and get it resolved? And I'm looking from Israel's side of it as, hey, we're going to go until we get it finished. Why is that difficult, and what are they facing?
I think if it weren't for the world reaction a couple of weeks ago, they would have already attacked Rafah. They were prepared to do it. They have a really good process of taking these tunnels out. They've lost very few people in these tunnels. They use robots. They use gas. They use water. You know, provide lots and lots of advance warning for people to get out. So I think it would have already happened. I think the world, not just the world opinion, but I think the United States has probably said, if we don't sign off on your attack in Rafah and how you're going to deal with the large populations, we're cutting off aid, or we're cutting off weapons or ammunitions, whatever. And I think they depend so much on the United States resupplying them that it became, battle strategic. And so, again, what I hear is that the United States knows they're going to attack Rafah and has not told them not to. They just want cover. And that's happening now. You know, I saw something about 50,000 tents have just moved into, control areas in Gaza that the Israel controls to be able to start resettling people that want to come north. There's lots and lots of people that are, because they've pulled out some of their troops, that are already moving out of southern Gaza. So in a way, Gaza, Rafah and that area in the very, very, in the very deep south, where probably all the hostages are that are left, and all the remaining leaders of Hamas. And there's not a lot, you know, they've killed most of the leaders of Hamas, but the few that are left are there. And so I think that the population will be allowed in, you know, in some organized way to move. And then I think the attack will happen.
Yeah.
That's what I hear, is that there's nothing that's holding that up other than probably the United States has said, we have to sign off in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll, when we come back next week, Denny's going to continue. We'll talk about Rafah a little bit. Talk a little bit. You made a statement that we want to explore a little bit about the hostages. They want the hostages back, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what's the state of that and what's the probability of that. And then we do want to look at, because you also made a statement that Hezbollah and Iran are thinking of joining some aspects of it. You know, what are you hearing from that? So we got some great things we need to talk about. So it's interesting to and kind of see it live happening. Is that, you know, even, gosh, I think now what, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago, we said Rafah is going to happen, but because of the dynamics of it, it still hasn't. So we're gonna talk about that. And the neat thing is, we can listen to Denny give us this input, and then we'll see how it plays out, and then Denny will react to it. So Heavenly Father, we're just grateful for Denny and his ability to have this information coming from inside. And we just pray that we'll understand it. We know that ultimately the world does turn against Israel, but you protect Israel. And so we just pray that you help us understand the timing of it and the aspect of it and how we are to pray for it. And we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Thanks so much for joining us, Denny. Just a pleasure to have you and your insight on all of this. I know our listeners really appreciate it as well. So if you have questions, send them in to us at questions@abideministries.com. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.
We'll see you then.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Come and See, your podcast for truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. Send us your questions and comments and tune in tomorrow for more answers to your personal questions about living life in God's truth. Remember, God's will is best and none better. His truth brings peace in this world of chaos.